You're listening to the USCA official podcast, which takes you behind the scenes of eventing, covering all the big events, professional tips and tricks, interviews, special guests, and the latest USCA eventing news. Welcome to the USCA official podcast, episode 256. I'm Nicole Brown, and we have a very special episode for you today, listeners. It is all about rider fitness, and we have a brilliant guest who we hope is going to inspire you all to do some good work during these current challenging times, but also to help improve your performance. We're going to dip a little into sports psychology as well. Some of you may have heard of him. Some of you may have read about him. Some of you may have even worked with him. And I'm going to introduce you to Tony Sandoval. He is also known as Coach Sando, Coach Sando Training, hugely respected coach, and now specializes in equestrian disciplines. And I'm going to say a very, very warm welcome to the USCA official podcast.
Thank you for having me, Nicole. It's a pleasure. Can't wait to get started. I've been excited to do this for a while.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to it. It's been an episode, listeners, that I know we've teased you with for a little while, and it is finally here. So I really hope that there is going to be some good stuff that you can take from it. Let's start by talking a little bit about your background and your philosophy towards coaching, because actually you didn't come from an equestrian background originally, did you?
I did not. I was trained as a collegiate strength and conditioning coach. So I spent a majority of my career in universities and colleges coaching sports like American football, basketball, and probably about 15, 16 other, we call them Olympic sports. And I did that again for about over 13 years, 14 years. And then I had an opportunity to start working with a rider. And that rider then turned into a couple more. And I fell in love with it. And I have not trained any other type of athlete since.
That's amazing. And you actually have learned to ride and everything, haven't you, to kind of understand what you're training more?
Yes, we're going to call it learning. It's more of just an experience. But yes, just when I'm an animal lover, and just being around the horses and understanding personalities and moods and just curiosity, right? Understanding what a rider goes through, what the feeling is, was really important to me. So I made it a point to make sure that I visit as many farms and as possible and get to know all the X's and O's of what a rider has to do, even just down to tacking up a horse. I was like a kid in a candy shop when I tacked up my first horse. I was smiling ear to ear where all the other riders were wondering, why is he so excited that we'd have to do this so many times? But for me, it was such a new experience. I got that curry brush and I was just like 20 minutes just rubbing muscle. You know, the horse was probably falling asleep, but yeah, I was very excited and still am to just keep learning about the sport and the culture.
And it combines your first love of fitness. And mm-hmm. You mentioned a word there, actually, when we were talking about what you do, strength and conditioning. Now, it's a term that is often referred to in fitness, and we understand, I think, loosely what it means. But for anybody that sort of hears it and thinks, actually, you know, strength, conditioning, I kind of get it, but I don't really. What is it? Break it down for us.
Okay. So I'll step up back and I'm going to frame this by talking about the philosophy that I have and that I've developed through the years of working with athletes. And, you know, on my website and a lot of my social media posts, my big motto is redefining equestrian performance. And what I mean by that is what we're trying to do is build the most athletic, healthy, and injury-free rider as possible. So in order to do that, we have to apply different types of principles to make sure that we're taking care of all these different variables that have to do with sports performance. Now, as a strength and conditioning coach, what that means is I like to also mention things like, my big one that I'll start off with is fitness does not equal performance. And I know that that seems very off, because fitness, you would be thinking it's a component, yes. But if you just leave it at fitness, you are not going to see the benefits when it's time for you to perform. So strength and conditioning is a performance-based way of training that takes under consideration things like muscle. So I'll start off with muscle contractions. So we're going to talk about strength, power, explosiveness. The next component is mind. You have to have a way to train your coordination, train your balance, train your proprioceptive abilities to understand your body and state. The next thing that it addresses is cardiovascular health. So conditioning is what we call it, or energy system development. And I know it gets really confusing on what's what, but we want to make sure that your training, your heart and your lungs and all of those respiratory systems to be able to handle the stress of riding. Because if you're training and you're taking classes or doing some type of fitness program and it addresses one part of your fitness, but not the actual part of your fitness that you use when you're riding, then we would say, although good for fitness, not good for performance. Another component is health. We try so hard to make sure that there is a form of recovery so that you can get an adaptation. So again, a principle in strength and conditioning is going to be a three-part process to actually seeing results. Number one, you have something called a stimulus, like a workout program, something that's going to elicit the body to make a change. Then the next part is going to be the recovery. That's the process in which the body takes the stimulus, says, okay, these are the changes we're going to make, which leads to the third process, which is an adaptation. But if you don't focus to recover as hard as you train, your training will not have any adaptation or benefit to your performance. And then the last thing, which this is the main reason why I started working with riders, is the injury. Strength and conditioning programs were designed to help prevent the risk of injury and to make sure that we can get athletes that have been injured, make them have a successful road back to return to play, is what we call it, RTP. So within that strength and conditioning umbrella, that's how we manage athletes. That's how we help them along their performance journey. I hope I didn't say too much there and confuse people.
I'm listening completely fascinated, because it is very, very true what you say, that somebody could go and run a marathon. They could be super fit in fitness terms, but actually they get on a horse and that fitness doesn't actually give them the advantages that they're looking for.
So I'll use that example to explain the fitness does not equal performance. When you're running gated exercise like that, sometimes, and I see this with the runners just in general that I try to help because they're dealing with pain, they get a lot of hip issues. Hips are very unstable. They get a lot of knee pain. They get a lot of joint pain. Now imagine if somebody's running a marathon and has weak hips, weak glutes and hamstrings, their balance is off because it's all bipedal. They're not really, they haven't trained in balance. And then you put them on a saddle. What type of performance, what tools do they have that maybe help them in running, but may not help them when they're riding a horse, right? So it's not that the fitness component of a marathon is not beneficial, of course, but it's kind of like, you know, if you're a hammer and that's all you have, then everything that you see is going to be a nail. And that's not how performance works. We have to make sure that we give an athlete as many tools as possible so that when they do go for a run or they ride on their horse, if they're competing in any type of discipline, that they have the tools needed to come out, not only have good performances, but to me, what matters the most is to be safe.
Yeah, and actually that is a massive part of what hooked you into eventing in the first place. And something that I think, actually, until I started talking to you and until I started to actually think about it, I I suppose I didn't really realize the impact it could have. And I think there might be a lot of people listening that don't quite realize that. Before we go on to it, in terms of performance, so general strength and conditioning in terms of honing those fine skills for riding and for your chosen discipline, whatever it might be, eventing, show jumping, dressage, whatever it might be, what sort of marginal gains can that give you?
I think, from my experience, I should say, the gains are going to be in stages, but the gains are going to be very, very noticeable within a few weeks. And the reason I say that is because I work with a wide variety of athletes that go from high school age all the way to athletes that are in their 60s. And no matter what level they're at, they're always coming back to me and saying, I can feel things now that I haven't been able to feel before. Or as the older athletes, my shoulders are not hurting as bad. My back is not hurting as much as it did before. And that's after a few weeks. I had one lady, she tested me. We had an assessment. I did some manipulation to some of her joints and gave her some soft tissue work, which was a form of massage that I did on her. She tested me that night and said, I just mounted my horse and was not in pain. Thank you. I can't wait to see what's coming up in the future. It's just noticeable that when you treat riders and when they focus on the right things, the improvements and the noticing those improvements come really fast.
And actually, this is amazing as well, because if it was our horse that we thought might be a little bit sore or might be a little bit uncomfortable through the back, or, you know, it just was finding, going on the left rein or a certain movement a little bit more difficult, we'd be all over trying to make sure it was better. And we'd have the vet, the physio, the chiropractor, everybody out to try and make them better. But actually, often with ourselves, we can neglect ourselves when actually we're just as an important part of a component in terms of the overall performance as the horse.
I think you're exactly right. With my younger college age riders, I have a lot of interaction with them in person. I train a couple college team in person, and I always ask them, if your horse had to pick a sound rider, would they pick you?
Yeah.
You know, we train in the morning, and sometimes the energy level is not there, but I make them think about that. If your horse were to walk around and pick which rider was the soundest, I could sense your energy level, would they pick you? Because when it's the other way around, that's definitely what humans do. We pick the best looking horse, confirmation, how sound, what's their medical record like. So if it gets you to think in that mindset, am I preparing myself to be a good teammate? Am I a good teammate?
Yeah.
And that usually gets them a little fired up.
I was going to say, do they stand a little straighter and put in a little extra work?
There's a lot less yawns and a little bit more attention to detail, for sure.
Absolutely. Okay, we touched upon it briefly, the bigger picture. You know, we've talked about how it can reduce pain and it can improve performance and those things. But actually, equestrian sports, eventing in particular, is a dangerous sport. There is a danger attached to it. And we, do everything that we can to help reduce those risks. But they are there nonetheless. Now, actually, strength and conditioning work is one of the things that, and I didn't realize this quite so much before we started talking about it, but actually the work that people can do at home can actually make it safer for them if they have a fall.
Yes. I think off saddle training and addressing any of your, I'm going to call them injuries, but it might be imbalances. It might be any of these other issues, mental stress, anything that prevents you from having a better connection with your horse is something that you can work off of your horse to make sure that by the time you get on them, then you're a little bit more in tune of what's going on. When you are riding with pain, and this is not just for equestrian athletes, this is in general as human beings, because you love what you do, your body is going to try to mask pain, and it's going to desensitize those transmitters that are telling the brain there's something wrong in this joint for the sake of writing. The problem with that is when you start doing that, the ability for your body to acquire a new skill or to hone a new skill is not as high as when you are not in pain. There are only certain pathways to the brain. It's not going to be able to allow you to learn a different skill set or improve on one when it's trying to manage pain. Instead, what it does, it's going to compensate, and that is not a choice that you have sometimes. So if you are coming in with pain, you're trying to learn a new skill, it's going to be really hard for you to learn because little do you know, you're now needing to adjust your stirrup, or you're needing to ride a little different so that the pain goes away, so that in your head, now you're not hurting. So you think you're learning a new skill, but you're actually not.
That's really interesting, actually. We often talk to riders who, I know I spoke to a rider on the Eventing podcast recently who had suffered a serious head injury. And actually, one of the things that she found most affected was her balance. And all she could think about was actually she was now untraining her horses. Every training session she did, because her balance was off, she was actually doing she was trying to do good and improve their training and their performance, actually it was going in the opposite direction. And until she got herself right, there wasn't going to be anything that she could do to actually improve her performance and her horse.
That's exactly it. And every strength and conditioning professional, we all battle the same thing. How do we keep our athletes healthy? And can they understand the importance of it as much as we do? Because when you're an athlete, all you want to do is compete. You mask it. I have people that sometimes tell me they're not hurt when they really are. It's because they don't want to get told you cannot ride. So I understand that side of it. But there is another way. There are better ways to make sure that you can still keep riding, but you're working on some things at home. There's protocols that you can do that are, you don't need any equipment to use. It's just being consistent. And I think having a different mindset of taking care of the details to make you sound just like you would your horse. Because I don't know how many people push their horse through injury, but they'll push themselves, right, through injury.
Yeah, we're all guilty for it, I think. And often we need to sit back and kind of go, no, like we've already said on this show, do you know what, we're as an important part of this team as the horses. Can I ask you about a rider that you work with and have worked with for a little while? One, I think, that actually really hooked you into the sport of eventing, Ali Knowles, who I'm sure many listeners on this show are going to be familiar with. Now, she had a really bad rotational fall a few years ago now. And actually, the work that she had done with you and the fact that she was so strong from a strength and conditioning perspective actually meant that that fall was nowhere near as bad, even though it was pretty awful, nowhere near as bad as it could have been. And that was because she was strong. Is that right?
That is right. She called me right before she was going to have her surgery and told me that's what the doctors told her, that the muscle mass that she had acquired, and because she was so strong and her bones were so dense, that saved their life. And then hung up, and I was going, wait, hello, who is this?
You were like, what?
I didn't even know. She just led with that. She did not say, hey, it's Allie, this is what happened. She just started talking. I think maybe maybe some of the relaxant started kicking in, and she was just calling it a little delirious. But I don't remember her saying what was going on, which was leading me to believe, like, what? Wait, now I'm worried. What's going on? Wait, you're going to have surgery? And then later on, when she called me back, she told me what had happened. And I've had in my career a lot of people thank me for, you know, bringing them back from injury, making them better players, making them better people. Like that, I think that's why I love what I do, because I help so many people, and I can see the improvement. And you just get hooked on the feeling of helping people. But I had never had any athlete tell me I helped save their life. Never.
Yeah.
And that's when I thought, okay, this is what I'm meant to do. I'm going to work with writers because I'm sure she's not the only one.
Yeah. And do you know what? When you think about it, it makes sense. If we are stronger, then we are surely far more, we're in a far better position to protect ourselves, because our bodies, our brains are incredible things. And if we are stronger, then we're in a position to protect ourselves if we have that those sorts of situations. And it's one of those things that actually you probably, Ali probably didn't think when she first started training that that was what she was training to help for. Like, that wouldn't have been the aim and goal. But actually, it's a really, really valid point. And I think something that we can all kind of go, do you know what? Actually, it's a responsibility to be safer. And if I can make a few changes at home, and you don't have to make all of the changes, but if you can make a few changes to actually help make you stronger and help sort of make you as well prepared to go into competition as you can be, then that can only be a good thing. And it goes a little bit further than that, doesn't it? Because you can actually do certain exercises that help make your neck stronger, that would help reduce the risks of concussion and things like that.
Yes, that's one of the things that I did when I started working with Ali post her injury, because again, I had never worked with a writer. I didn't even know Ali was a professional. She was very humble and just an athlete. I ride horses, help me. She had been fit already. Again, I'm going to use the word fit, right? She was very, very fit and took that seriously. I just helped tune some things up. But what happened was that as you get to a level of fitness and as you get to start polishing up some things, you start to notice, okay, what are some things that need to happen as well? And when I started doing my assessments of the sport and watching videos, actually now diving in, I started noticing, wow, I see all these concussions, but I've never seen anything online or anybody talk about, you know, any trainer or anything talk about how to actually prevent concussions besides, you know, wearing a helmet. But I come from the sport that there's so much technology and there's so much money spent on preventing concussions in football, and the helmets are so, so technically advanced, and they still get them because we understand now that it has to do not just with the equipment, but also the strength of the neck, the flexibility of the neck, learning how to anticipate falls, which is why I've also just through in this community, I've had a strong relationship built with, Landsafe, with Danny Warrington, and our philosophies are matching about how to keep athletes safe, because those are some things that I thought I need to make a training program for riders. I need to help them understand how to stay safe with falls and how to not get concussed. And if you do get concussed, that your job is not to get on another horse. Your job is to recover, because this is a long-term sport. It's not something that you're chasing glory for, you know, one more ride where it's going to affect you long-term, where you can't even remember your name or worse.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there any exercises that people can do at home and sort of within the comfort of their own home that they could kind of build into their own routines that would help those sorts of injuries, sort of strengthen the neck? And
there sure is. So there is a process on how to work with your neck, because it is a very sensitive part of your body, being the cervical area. The first part is the range of motion, to stretch. So if you did a little test, and if you look over to your right and your chin was not really close to your shoulder, then you would know you'd have some type of compromised range of motion. So even performance wise, say you're going through some gymnastics or you have a jump and you have to turn, you wouldn't have the ability to turn with only using your head, because your range of motion would be compromised. So you'd have to shift your trunk. So if we have that comparison to driving, that would mean that in order for you to change lanes, you actually have to turn the whole car. Well, that's not how we change lanes. We change lanes by turning just our head and making sure that the lane is free or safe. So for me, it serves as a two-part exercise. Number one, see if you have the range of motion to have good performance. But number two, if you have a compromised range of motion as far as getting that chin, we'll say, to the shoulder, then if there was a fall, since you are not very comfortable with that range of motion, the stiffer you are and the less pliability you have when you fall, that you have a higher likelihood of getting concussed, because the range of motion that your neck is comfortable in is so small. But when you fall, you have to have a lot of range of motion in your neck to be able to stabilize. I don't know if that makes sense.
I'm sat here, probably like a lot of other people listening to this show, twisting my neck back and forth, thinking, oh my God, I've definitely got a compromised range of motion in my neck. Mm-hmm. That's a really simple thing to actually test, isn't it? And I've just surprised myself.
Yes.
I think I need to work on that. We'll get some tips on. Okay, go on then. Give us a quick tip on how we can improve that. Is there an underlying problem? Is it just a case of building sort of strength in the neck area? How would you improve that?
So the improvement, there's the answer is never just one specific thing, especially when you're talking about the human body. One part affects the other. But I would suggest, I'd say for you and as yourself as an example, if you turned to your shoulder and you couldn't get all the way there, I would ask, how is your posture? Do you feel that your shoulders are rounded forward? Are you always sitting down? I would ask these questions because if you have a compromised posture, just there is not going to be any room for your neck to have any room for range of motion, because the middle of your back, your shoulder blades are moving forward, which is going to decrease the range of motion that your cervical spine can have to move from left to right, up and down, because the middle of your spine is compromised. Does that make sense?
Well, when you started mentioning posture, I realized that when I went to test my original neck movement, I had to sit up straight to do so. So yes, 100% makes sense. Yes.
So once we get that down, so once I see someone and I see their posture, I say, okay, we're going to work on posture. We're going to work on getting a little bit more range of motion in your shoulder blades and getting some muscles stronger. But for the neck, simple stretches is if you go back to that shoulder and you're taking a big deep breath and you're just breathing in. So I'm taking about 2 to 3 seconds of a breath in. I'm holding it for a second and I'm breathing out. And then I'm still now trying to move my chin closer to my shoulder, and I'm holding it there. And as I'm breathing out, I'm still in that position. Then you're going to take another big deep breath and you're going to breathe out, and you're going to try to push even more towards that shoulder. What you're going to notice as you stay in those, we call it end ranges of motion, and you concentrate on breathing and relaxing, the muscle will start to let go and give you that range of motion. Most of the time, our necks are so stiff because of this horrible word called stress. And stress tightens up the muscles of the neck. It brings your shoulders up to your ears, which at that point, how are you going to turn left to right if you don't have the right musculature loose enough, we'll call it mobile enough, to be able to operate properly? So that exercise just gives you an understanding of breathing, the importance of being relaxed when you ride. That way muscles are mobile. Even if you trained and you had all the mobility, but you stiffen up because of nerves when you ride, that's not going to be beneficial, which now I'm going into another part. And sorry if I'm going a little bit ahead of myself.
Not at all.
Just and to show.
Do you know what? Actually, I was just doing that. And by taking deep breaths, I actually felt more relaxed as well. So there is, you know, this is something really simple that you can do at home. Let's mm-hmm. go into the next part, because actually that mm-hmm. links sports psychology into your training as such, don't you? And it kind of intertwines very nicely.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's a lot of coaches and just doing my homework in the equestrian field. There's a lot of great people out there really doing some good work, helping riders with the sports psychology part of it. And so that's very promising. And I get encouraged when I see that. And there are two parts in my experience of sports psychology. The first part is what everyone is doing right now, or a lot of the professionals, sports psychologists that are helping riders. And I think that there's another part, and that's the connection between the mind and the physical component. So now that you understand the first part, which is, you know, visualization, breathing, positive talk, learning how to get out of negative thoughts into some positive talk, those are all what I would call the visual, the more the mental, but then the mental has to lead into the physical. And that's where I teach writers how to actually do things that are going to put them in positions where they have to learn how to focus and how to get things from the mind onto the into the real part of the world, which is probably writing things down, understanding what goals are. And from the goals, then it's actually doing the physical component, which is, okay, I am going to train this way to reach my goal. I am going to do these physical things, because most of the time people that are, you know, they might look at sports psychology and think, I don't know if I need it. It's closing my eyes and visualizing doesn't really help. But you know what does help is writing things down that actually can, you can see it on a piece of paper. I have all of my writers fill out something called an AAR form, which I adopted from the military. It's called After Action Review. And it basically makes you write down what are the things that you're expecting to do when in your next show, what actually happened during the show, why did that particular thing happen, what are some things that you could do different to expect a different result, and what are some things that were successful that you can repeat? And there's a couple other questions, but basically that's how it is. That way you can have a quantitative way to think about what happened, because that form, when you look back at it, is going to build you confidence. And confidence is something that you build through an assessment of what happened, understanding failure, accepting failure. And there was, I'm going to put a side note there. When I was in UCLA, there was a coach there, and she would recruit her athletes on one of these, I think, variables, the ability to fail and then recover. So her mindset was, I don't care if you make mistakes. I am interested in the athlete that can recover fast from the mistakes and keep it moving forward. The next jump, the next day, the next whatever it is. Because if you have this tendency to stay in the failure for too long, that's not what she wanted. That doesn't build champions or bring home championships. And I just always admire that. So for me, this is a way for me to make my writers understand what went wrong. It's fine. Write it down, and then let's make a plan so that doesn't happen. Failure and recover. Failure and recover. And so with me, this is how I make sure that writers are staying in tune with what's going on in their head. And then, which is the next part of my process, is the physical component, which is I try to make them as uncomfortable as possible. Physically, your brain starts to wonder once you start training really at a really high intensity. And there are very few writers that I know that I've worked with that have that experience at training at such high intensity. And when they do, that those are my coaching moments, that I can start giving them the skills to understand how to calm down, how to be poised when there's this adversity in front of them. Yes, you got two more sprints and your legs are burning. Calm down, relax, think about all the training that you're doing. How is this going to help you? So there's this whole other component that only comes through physical fitness or physical exhaustion that I try to put my athletes under, because if you understand what you just did, that should build you more confidence. And that confidence piece when you're writing is everything. And as I get to talk to more professional writers and find out what the difference is, besides obviously your teammate, your horse, and the experience that you may have, but if you go in there and you're confident in what you're doing, your teammate's going to sense that. And there is where I think it all ties in. So I hope I didn't lose anybody in my explanation on how I get it done, but that's how I've been finding a lot more success with teaching writers how to use these tools that I've been using with college athletes for a long time.
I think they're things that people can actually do simply at home. You know, if people are in the UK or wherever in the world that they are, they're listening to this, that actually there's things from that they can take. Even in just filling the AAR form, that it's very easy to go to a competition and you might not go to another competition for, you know, 3-4 weeks. And by the time you've got to your next competition, you've either forgotten all the good things that happened. You might remember that one stride that you missed in the show jumping, and that's all you can focus on. But you've forgotten all of the good things that you did, and you're just simply focusing on that, or vice versa. And it's something so simple to do that actually just write it down, because then you are held accountable for it. You can quantify it and it's all fresh in your mind at the time. And actually the point that you make on sort of pushing yourself and the physical limits in training, I find really interesting. And we're going to come on to a bit of a question on it later as well.
Yeah.
Because actually, I suppose if you've pushed yourself in training, that actually when you get to a competition, it should be straightforward, or it should be within your comfort zones.
Right. That's exactly it.
And if it's not, then at least you've been there, you know to take a breath, and you know that you'll come out the other side.
And I think that, you know, there's variables, or there's, we'll say, attributes that people have that makes them professionals. Not, you know, there's just like any other sport, not everybody can be a pro, but you look at them and you go, what can I do? How can I get there? There's some things that I can improve on. Because the level of focus that I see these riders, I went to the showcase in Aiken before all of this happened, and just watching all those professionals, just their demeanor, how they go about things, just walking over to where their trailers were, just what did they do pre-ride, warm-up area. It's very interesting from that perspective of, I don't know what they do for training. I don't know anything about their horse, but their demeanor, their look, you know, I've been in so many competitions and sat on so many benches and just looked at the intensity and the feel of competition. It, you know, it gets me all excited. And when I watch these riders prepare, I just go, yeah, this is my end piece. You know, if I'm trying to build riders, I got to know what I'm building towards. And this type of attention to detail, this type of focus is what I see. That way, when I get back to my lab and I'm working with the athletes that I'm working with, I know exactly what it's supposed to look like and how to get them there.
Yeah. And I think that's then, again, I guess, building from other sports, you know, because yes, equestrianism is different in so much as you've got a horse and a rider, but actually you can still take tools and you can still take inspiration from all the other sports in the world. Can I ask you, because we touched about it a little bit earlier on in the show in terms of attention to detail with our horses. Mm-hmm. You know, we would never dream of going to a show and just jumping on our horses and leaving the start box to go cross country. We would have warmed them up. We would have made sure that they'd had a few practice fences. We would have made sure that they'd had a gallop so that their you know, lungs were open a bit and they were sort of in the zone to go. But quite often, riders don't necessarily do anything specific to them, yet the horses do warm up. So what can riders do to sort of make sure that they are as prepared as possible?
That's a good question, because that I always have to battle with that with a lot of my riders. I'm not going to talk about what people do, what I do try to have them do. It's building this habit, and this habit has to do, it starts during training and during your preparation. But when you're at a show, it's just an extension of what you've been doing as a habit. And if as a habit, you're already in tune with how your body feels, what stretches you need to do, how to warm up, how to prepare yourself mentally, then it's just a checklist during the competition. So for instance, I'm going to give some examples. If I have an athlete, I take them through a warm-up, and the warm-up involves warming up your hips, your hamstrings, your quads, all of your trunk and spine stabilizers. I am going to work on your posture, make sure that those muscles are turned on properly, and then I'm going to get your heart rate up and move those things dynamically, because you're not, although you are, people would look at, people like me that are new to the sport, would look at it and say, they just have to kind of hold on. Muscles are working dynamically, even though your body may not look like it's moving, but at a cellular level, they're definitely moving. Things are happening. So I try to warm people up dynamically. If there's an issue that somebody may have where they have, you know, they're trying to get clear of lower back pain, I will have some modalities that will fire, we're going to say, or activate their glute muscles and their core muscles. That way the back starts thinking, okay, I don't have to work because the hips are strong and my trunk and spine muscles are going to do a lot of the stabilizing, not the lumbar spine. And so it all depends, but this is again done in training. So that way, when you go to your show, you're just carrying that on and then you're ready to go, because if you practice it, if you're comfortable with it, that carries over to performance. If I have someone that is not used to it, and then during their show weekend, they do a specific thing, I don't even add that variable in there. But that's what I'm trying to keep fighting and pushing, that, hey, if I'm coming in to watch you ride, I better see you warm up, because I want to see what your body is actually doing when it's prepared, not just tack up, you warm the horse up, and then you go through your flat work or you've got some cross-country schooling, but you yourself are nowhere near warmed up like the horse is. Yeah. So some people, they'll get around and say, oh, of course I warmed up, I'm ready to go. And I don't see it, and I go, all right, I can kind of tell when you're not warmed up. So it's a cultural thing. It's more of, I spent this energy tacking up my horse, I don't want them waiting, which is, I get it now. I get it. You don't want that horse waiting while you warm up. But it could be three exercises, Nicole. It could be two exercises that you can do just to get yourself ready. Or ideally would be, well, before you even start tacking on the horse, how about you get your tack box and do a couple of these stretches that I've shown you on the tack box? That'll get you ready, and it'll last 5 minutes. And 5 minutes might be a difference between a bad session or a great session.
Yeah, totally makes sense. Are there a couple of exercises that would be, obviously everybody is different and everybody has different things, but a couple of your sort of go-to exercises that people could do?
Yes, the first one, we'll use the tack box, because I always told people, well, just get on the floor and do this exercise. But again, that was me before I actually started visiting barns and understanding what the floor.
There were these big horses around.
Yeah, these horses. And it's just, I went, oh, okay, I understand now. So to make it at least easier for someone to do is to get the tack box. And there is a yoga pose called the pigeon stretch, where you cross your leg in front and you lay down on there, because it focuses not only just lower back, but also glutes, hip, all those surrounding hip muscles to stretch. So what someone would do is just hike their leg up. And if you can imagine laying your shin from your knee to your foot flat on the tack box, and you just laying on your leg and while having the other leg straight, and then pushing yourself down slowly as you're breathing, and you'll start feeling that hip stretch and open up more than anything. And you're just going, breathing in, breathing out, getting in and out of that stretch, maybe about 5 reps per leg. That one alone would make me happy. But, if you do have some time, then with addressing the lower back issue and getting your pelvis to be loose, I also have an exercise where you're standing a little bit away from your tack box, put that heel up on that tack, or your leg up on that tack box, keep your heel down. So a lot of people want to point their toes, and I always give this analogy, just like you would keep your heels down in a stirrup, keep your heels down when you're stretching your hamstring. And then slowly but surely reach out to that foot. Why do we want to focus on that hamstring? Because if the hamstring is tight, the hamstring, it inserts and originates in the hip. So if the hamstrings are pulling down on the hip, your lower back is not going to be happy. So if you loosen up your hamstring, loosen up your glutes, your back is going to be able to now be used as a stabilizer, not as a mobilizer. And it only mobilizes when the hamstrings are very tight and your glutes are very tight. So those two exercises are probably my go-tos if somebody just had time for two.
And actually, that's quite nice, because those two exercises, you're sort of in your own headspace, you are quietly breathing, you're concentrating, and actually that will help reduce those nerves and keep you calm before you get on and go and do whatever you've got to do. I like those a lot, actually, and I hope a few of our listeners will be liking them as well. And I think the one thing that has come across in this show, and listeners, I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have, is that there are small adjustments that you can make in everyday life. And all of those small adjustments, if you make a few, then they make bigger and bigger impacts on your performance and on your fitness and general well-being as well. And that is something that at the moment we're recording this during a very uncertain time in the world with COVID-19, and a lot of people's routines are totally out of sync. A lot of people that would usually go to the gym or do a lot of riding aren't perhaps able to do that. And so I think all of these things are really, really important to bear in mind. Can I ask you, before we finish, Tony, for some top tips? So if people are just starting out, or if their routines have changed and they're therefore at home a lot, are there a few top tips that you can give them that will make a difference for them?
Yes, I definitely have some top tips. And I think the first one is going to seem pretty obvious, but I'm saying this because at this time, like you mentioned, people's routines and their schedules are not usual, but I want everybody to take advantage of that. And so my first tip is to make time to train, make it a routine, because one of the biggest excuses that I get from riders is I don't have time to train. I ride so many horses, or I'm at the barn, I can't find the time to work out. I'm so tired. Use this time to build it into your schedule. That way, once it's a routine, whether you're motivated or not, that won't matter. It's just like brushing your teeth. If you make time to train, it'll happen and you'll see the benefits from those actions. The second tip that I have is to make sure that when you're training to acquire tools, not to tone. And what do I mean by that? If your training involves a lot of just fitness things to get in shape, that is probably just toning things. But if you think about your training, is it giving you tools to perform? That's when you're going to start asking some questions. Well, what does that mean? Make sure that you're addressing your flexibility, your range of motions that you have issues with when you're riding. Make sure that you have some sort of training program that's going to address if you have lower body strength issues or balance, that you have that. It's not just enough just to go and do random exercises that you research on YouTube and think that that's going to help. If we're talking about performance, it's all about acquiring these tools. And number three, I think it goes along with number two, is make sure you work with a professional that understands how to give you those tools, that knows how to give you a good analysis and understand what you need to build to improve your athleticism, and most importantly, to keep you healthy.
Very important. I think is something that everybody has to just keep in mind, is make sure that you're doing everything properly and don't take any risks, because actually ultimately that would be counterproductive as to what we're looking for. Now, if anybody is a little bit unsure as to what they can do, you actually have, because of all the current situation, you've created a free program that people can follow if they wish to do so, can't they?
Yes, I sat down when all this was going on and I thought, how can I help the community? I want to make sure that everybody has access to the training program that would be free, and that would be at a very basic level, but understand what they're actually getting and can maybe check off, wow, this is not what I'm currently doing, this is different, and give them a little bit of an education as to what sports performance should look like. So they can go onto my website, which is www.coachsandotraining.com. And on that homepage, you'll see a link to download this free 6-week at-home training program. Zero equipment is needed. If you follow me on Instagram at Coach Sando Training, I give videos on how to do that training program. But that document, that PDF, has links to all the videos, so you'll know exactly what you're doing during the whole training program.
Yes. And then you can follow it. And if you're not sure what a certain stretch is, so I have to admit, I went and Googled the pigeon stretch. But if you're not sure what they are, then they're all shown on there and it shows you how to do them as well. So it gives you a lot of guidance to get you started. So if you're unsure where to start, that is a starting point. We hope that we've mentioned a few different things through the podcast. I know I'm definitely going to be working on my neck strength and my posture. And I hope, listeners, that you've found something from here to really take away and work on, and that will help you in your sports performance and in your eventing, or whether it just be in daily life and reducing pain and making yourselves fitter, happier and healthier as well. So thank you so much, Tony. We've absolutely loved having you on the show. It has been absolutely fascinating. So thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. I had a great time.
It's been brilliant. And listeners, we hope you've enjoyed this episode of the USEA official podcast. Don't forget that we would love to hear from you. Get in touch at US Eventing. And if you have any suggestions for future episodes of the show, then make sure you get in touch with those as well. And we will see what we can do. But for now, that is all we've got time for. And we'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening to the USEA official podcast. If you have any suggestions or feedback, then we would love to hear from you. Get in touch through any of our social media platforms at US Eventing, and don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform to make sure you don't miss an episode.